This is Saturday, March 28th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news and your calls with questions and comments about technology.
GeekSpeak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
There we go. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. This is Miles Elam, filling in for Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today we have an air room packed full of geeks. It should be a good show. In the second half, we'll invite you to call into the show with questions and comments. We'd also like to invite you to join us on our Etherpad. Go to etherpad.com/geekspeak. That's etherpad.com/geekspeak. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Miles Elam. In the air room with me are geeks. Al Luckow, new media architect.
Hello, world.
Except that I don't have you guys potted up. Let's try that again.
Hello, world.
And one more time.
Hello, world.
So nice.
I'm a person.
Ben Jaffe, freelance media guy.
Morning.
Ryder Brooks, support engineer at Sun Microsystems.
Good morning.
Let's see. Let's try that one again. Are you on three?
Yep.
There
I'm on three. Good morning.
You're so quiet. And returning now, the Tech Nomads, Chris Dumphy and Cherie Viard.
It is good to be back on GeekSpeak.
Good morning.
It's good to have you. So let's get started with some geek news. Ben, you want to tell us a little bit about 3D CAPTCHAs?
Yeah, so CAPTCHAs are those things when you go to websites and you register, for example, for a new email or an account on some page, to keep people from spamming that, they implement these things called CAPTCHAs, which are, you've probably seen them, they're the distorted characters, and they say type in the characters that are in the above image. Well, they've had to make them more and more difficult to read because OCR, optical character recognition technology, it's been getting better and better. So the spammers can get past it more and more easily. So they've come up with a new type of CAPTCHA. It uses 3D images. So like one of the examples, it'll show you a picture of an airplane from kind of a skewed angle, this three-dimensional airplane, this image of a 3D airplane model. And then it'll say match it to any one of the following objects. It gives you a list. And the airplane in the list is not skewed. And so the idea is that our brains can say, oh, that image is an airplane just kind of from a sideways angle. And then we can see the other airplane and match that and say that those are both airplanes. But computers have a really hard time determining that.
Right. So, okay. So that's something that you can't have a computer just go in and fill out forms on a blog or things like that. And that obviously sounds a lot easier than a lot of the text that's been on websites.
Yeah, I've actually continuously failed these.
When they had
like
all the lines through them.
Five or six times in a
dots,
row,
yeah.
And you have to retype in all of the.
Some of them will talk to you. They'll actually speak the letters.
That's true. Those are getting hard too, though. I mean, I don't know. They've got like a background noise, like other people talking, and then someone's kind of talking over them, but only a little bit over them. So. Hmm. Computer recognition technology can't do it,
so
but we can.
We're trying to make things more complicated and hard to understand.
It's kind of a Turing test kind of thing where you're trying to test whether the person on the other side, the web server is trying to test whether the person on the other side is a computer or a person. And so obviously you only want people registering email addresses because, well... computers can do it a lot more quickly, and also if computers ever take over the world, then that'll be a problem.
Right. This does worry, though, about one of the main ways that people get by CAPTCHAs, which is they just take the image from the site and put it in front of another site, usually someone doing some game site or something more innocuous, something completely unrelated to, for example, Gmail.
Yeah.
And having people fill it out, so it still is a human being. So this doesn't get past that problem.
But. Definitely doesn't get past that problem. That's a bigger problem to deal with, where you're the spamming service is grabbing a the captcha image that it's trying to match, and it presents it to another human on a different service, and then that human fills out the captcha. So it's kind of like the computer isn't trying to fill out the captcha. The computer is using a human to fill out the captcha. So, but as far as getting past the programming problem of trying to get computers to not be able to do these things, this is another big step.
Great. Well, thank you, Ben. Al, want to tell us about green technologies?
Sure. There's a lot of people say that the era of traditional newspapers is dead, but I disagree. They still provide a valuable service, and here it is. USB sticks from recycled newspaper. They actually have...
Sorry, say that again?
It's USB sticks from recycled newspaper.
How does that work?
Well, you know, it's kind of... they, you know, you can make anything, a USB stick out of anything. You know, they have... you know, you go to any kind of conference, and they give away all these different things. But now they've got compressed newspaper that creates the USB drive enclosure. So you can, you know, use recycled newspaper and then print your logo on it and say, look how recycled we are, you know, or look how concerned about the environment we are, and give away these USB sticks. So they aren't really beautiful, but, you know, they are kind of using stuff. I mean, I guess you could use plastic.
Yeah, I just put my I just put my thumb drive through the wash, so I don't know how recycled newspaper would fare.
That, probably wouldn't be the thing to use for that. But speaking of recycling things, this one is one that Gilligan and the professor would especially love. It's a hard drive enclosure made out of recyclable, renewable bamboo. So it's a, and actually, you know, you think about Gilligan's Island, you remember all the radios and stuff made out of coconuts and bamboo things. But this is actually a really nice looking hard drive enclosure. It's got, you know, it looks like a hardwood floor, like a mini hardwood floor on the sides. It's square. It's even the metal is recycled. So it's a really kind of a, for being a recycled thing, you know, it's kind of cool looking. A lot of recycled stuff looks kind of earthy, crunchy, and this is sort of high tech and all, you know, all recycled, you know, or at least the enclosure portions.
Yeah, that's a really good technology to make recyclable, and external hard drive enclosure, because you're just enclosing something that can't necessarily be a recyclable. There's not much circuitry involved.
Right.
But.
Right.
And Al, you had something about... Tread or tires?
Oh, yeah. There's a company and called Tread, and they make environmentally friendly bags and cases out of old used tires. And the interesting thing is they purchase the tires from South American they're the inner tubes of South American trucks. So they go to South America and they, you know, buy up all these used inner tubes from, you know, South Americans, I guess, and recycle them into pretty cool looking things, you know, iPod cases, you know, cell phone cases, and they are really neat. Their website is also very cool, which I was a little surprised at when I went there. I thought I was going to see something really, you know, backwoodsy kind of, but it's a really high tech looking website. They've got cool looking objects made out of, you know, all these different kinds of recycled materials, and they recondition it so it looks brand new, like brand new stuff. It's actually worth checking out.
Okay. Ryder.
Yes.
You're up.
Okay. Which one do you want me to cover? Let's see.
Talk to us about security. It seems like there's a lot of good information here that people need to know about.
Okay. Well, I'll start with the one that's probably more relevant to people today. There's a new botnet worm that has been coming around. It's a rumor that's been shut down, so it may not be that serious, but I found it interesting because it actually impacts your average user's wireless or wired DSL cable modems / routers that people use, you know, to hook up their home networks from a single internet connection and they share their network. It's a botnet worm that connects to, right now it's mostly impacting OpenWRT and DDWRT routers, which are pretty popular with kind of some of the hacking community or people that want a little more oomph out of their DSL cable modem router. And basically, the vulnerability is that if you have your router externally open, you know, through a web port or...
Which a lot of people do if they're hosting a website.
Yeah. it's used primarily for administrative, you know, access. So you can SSH into your router or through the web port. A lot of people don't really change the security on it. They may just turn some stuff on and make it available, and that's the main way that this botnet can exploit your router and install what it does. And essentially, what it does is it installs a file from the internet. Changes the IP tables filtering on your router and blocks you from access out and in, or actually out on your router. So you'll see that you no longer have access to your router. You can't connect to it.
Okay. So bottom line, this is for people who are hobbyists that have hacked their DSL router. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what that means, if you don't know what OpenWRT is.
If you're just using a straight up Linksys router or something.
If you don't know what OpenWRT if you don't know what OpenWRT is, you don't have to worry about it.
And you probably don't need to worry about it if you're running something PC based. This is MIPS architecture only. So it's a very specific compiled code type vulnerability. So if you've heard of WWDRD or OpenWRT, you might be of interest in this thing. But like they say, there's rumor that it's been shut down. It's pretty simple to tell if you've actually been impacted. You can't access those ports, and you can take a look around. Okay. Basically, the easiest way to get rid of it is restart your router.
Okay. Actually, I wanted to do a quick announcement with regard to security since we're on the subject. There's the Conficker worm, which we've covered many times on the show before. The reason why making a special announcement about it is because the payload is set to hit on April 1st. And it's been covered in the news, but it's worth talking about it over again. And a quick way to see if you're infected or not, whether it's a problem, is to go to www.microsoft.com. If their website comes up, you're pretty much in the clear. If you can't see it, for some reason, you can browse the web, look at other sites, but you can't see microsoft.com, you might be infected. You need to have someone take a look at it.
What computers does that affect? I mean, is that just, you said Microsoft, is that mostly Windows things? Or
It's just a Windows-only virus. So if you have XP, Vista.
But it's a pretty big one.
And
it's really hard to detect and really hard to track down and remove.
What's the suspected payload for April 1st? Do they know what's going to happen or what the speculation is?
I actually haven't followed that. Okay. I don't know per se. One of the things about it is that it does have a very sophisticated command and control, meaning that someone can, en masse, be able to control hundreds of thousands of PCs that have been infected by this all at once and use it for whatever purposes they want to do this for.
Cool, unless your PC is infected.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating subject. I mean, it's from a technical point of view, it's a very interesting virus at the same time, it's something to be worried about. This is not something to just brush off. Really, if you have a Windows machine, go to look at Microsoft.com, verify that you're in the clear.
Yeah, and this is has a lot of variants, and it's difficult to detect with virus scanners. It's pretty insidious thing.
Okay, our mobile correspondents.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, it's been great to have you in the office.
Yeah, I think it's been a year plus since I've been back at GeekSpeak.
Has it been that long?
Last August.
Yeah, you have a new trailer now.
Yeah, we've got a new bigger house. It's legally one foot longer, but a lot more interior space and twice the solar power on the roof.
Do you have a website for that for people to see pictures?
Yeah, technomadia.com, TechNomadia.
And we'll be putting that up on the website for people to take a look.
Yeah.
So just to recap, you don't have a permanent home.
No, I know you geeks from when I was actually living here in Santa Cruz and doing the show weekly. But the last 3 years, I've been traveling full-time. And the last 2 years, Sheree's been traveling full-time with me.
Right, but I mean, traveling full-time is one thing. Like I had a travel job where I would get on a plane on a regular basis. At some point, about 50% of my time was spent on a plane or someplace in a hotel somewhere around the country. But you don't have a house. I mean, that's a house as we tend to think of it.
No, and I actually sold mine, finally successfully sold mine in Florida this past summer. So
congratulations.
We are both free of all ties.
No mortgage, no rent. Just occasionally have to pay for parking.
So how does your email find you?
Email is the easiest thing. But we actually do have a mail forwarding service in South Dakota for paper mail. So that's our legal address for things that aren't fully digital. And every month we get mail forwarded to us from this service in South Dakota.
Is South Dakota like the hub for people forwarding mail? Because I know other people that are traveling. A friend of mine, Johnny B, is traveling in his trailer, and he's using in South Dakota. Right. Is that like the place that when you travel, you somehow get a place in South Dakota? Or?
South Dakota is very friendly to full-time RVers, and one of the reason that people pick them is because they have no state income tax. So if you don't have a physical home, it's really easy to be a resident there because they only require you to show up once in your life, and that's to get a driver's license. And you never have to go back again for jury duty or vehicle inspections or anything like that. And there's other states around the country that are no income tax or have other advantages that full-time RVers choose for their various purposes. Hmm. We went with South Dakota because it just fit all of our...
It is probably cool to visit. I mean, you wouldn't I wouldn't mind visiting South Dakota once a year. I mean, it's kind of a neat place.
It's beautiful.
So, you know, so. Yeah, one of the perks was that you only have to go there once, but then we went there and we like fell in love with the state, and it's someplace we want to go back again and again because the people are cool and it's really, really beautiful.
Hmm. Wow. Things you don't know.
Yeah, things about South Dakota.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. Did you already cover, I was a little distracted there. Did you already cover the way that you get the internet access?
No. Our internet, we mostly use a Sprint air card hooked into a small, kind of the size of a deck of cards, a mobile router that makes a Wi-Fi hotspot wherever we go.
Okay. So what is the coverage like that like? Where have you hit dead spots?
Middle of downtown San Francisco sometimes. I mean, it's sometimes you get the dead spots, the places you least expect it. But there's decent coverage across the nation as long as you're near the major roads. And some days our commute is drive someplace where we can get cell coverage from our beautiful campground to, near the highway where there's better coverage.
So are you finding that it's getting easier over time to be mobile?
It is getting easier. And also on the new house, we had a cell phone booster antenna installed, an amplification system, a mobile command center basically, installed on the trailer so that we can boost up a signal if we're just getting a really marginal signal.
Okay. So what, a magnetic thing you drop on the roof?
It's actually permanently built in. There's an antenna on the roof, an amplifier, and then another antenna on the inside that rebroadcasts the signal. So it's not like just one cell phone or one air card's being amplified. It's anything inside the trailer is getting a boosted signal as if it had a 3-watt transmitter up on top of the roof. It Wonderful. Mostly works.
Okay, so looking at news, whoever looks at me first gets... Ben, do you have a news story?
Yeah, I guess I was paying most attention. There's this interesting news story about anonymization on social networks. So a lot of times what will happen is they will, for example, Facebook or Twitter or Flickr will be allowed to sell or give out anonymized information about you. So maybe your user habits or things like that. But what they do is they strip your name from it. They strip your username from it, and obviously your password and whatnot. But the interesting thing is, if you get some of this, if you get a database like this from a couple different social networking sites that any given user is on two or more, you can actually kind of figure out who these people are by kind of data mining, like looking at all of this massive amount of data and user habits and everything. So these people at the University of Texas in Austin are going to present a paper that they just released at a security conference in this year. And they said that they can show that a third of the users who can be verified to have accounts on both Twitter and Flickr, which is a microblogging site and a photo sharing site, can be re-identified in the anonymous Twitter graph with a 12% error rate. So they're saying that about 33%, a third of the people of all of these anonymous users, they can more or less identify by kind of crunching numbers and looking at all of this massive amount of anonymous information.
So do you see this as a deficiency of the technology that Twitter and Flickr are using, or do you see something inherent in the habits that people have for posting, that there are repeatable patterns or identifiable patterns?
Well, I think that we are the people that we are, and we can't just, snap our fingers and suddenly act like someone else on the internet, right? So I don't think it's a problem with the people on the internet necessarily. Maybe they divulge too much information sometimes. But again, the most personal information has been stripped from this. I think that it's a problem with you have I completely lost my train of thought right there.
It just kind of shows the power of data mining is anybody who's got enough data can extract things that you never would have thought imaginable out of it, including who you really are. And it's just the way that data mining works, and it's probably nothing anyone can do about it. Except, you know, be more cloak and dagger.
Isn't that rather also
maybe giving the users of these sites more control over whether or not their information gets shared, even if it is anonymous. Because, you know, they'll say, can we share your name, maybe? Can we share your username and things like that? But sometimes they don't even ask about sharing anonymous information because they assume that by stripping out your name and usernames, then that makes it safe. So, and it doesn't necessarily.
Well, thank you, Ben, for that story, as scary as it might be.
Yeah, we're scaring people today, aren't we?
Yeah, the world's a dangerous place.
Stop using computers and live in caves.
Al's got nice green solutions for us, and we're just scaring the hell out of everybody. Don't use the internet, anybody.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. I have in the air room Al Luckow, Ben Jaffe, Ryder Brooks, Chris Dunphy, and Cherie Vennard. Did I get that right?
Viard.
It's all right.
I always make fun of Lyle whenever he messes up a name.
And it's harder when you're on that side of the desk.
So if you want to call in, join the conversation. The numbers here at KOSP are 476-2800 and 1-800-655-5877 as a toll-free number if you're if you don't want to make that toll call. Once again, 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. So, Al.
Yeah.
Got some...
Sure, yeah. Got lots of things. One of the things that I think is kind of neat is nano cases. This is another green solution, by the way. I'm kind of in this green theme today, recycling, reusing. This company makes nano cases out of the old cassette tapes that we used to get, which, you know, just going and looking at them really brought back memories, just seeing all these old cassette tape things. And so the iPod Nano fits inside the cassette. It's a, you know, the recycled cassettes, they took out the tape and everything. And they're really neat. It's just another really neat thing. It mostly fits the fourth generation iPod Nano, and they have 45 different styles of tapes that they've recycled to do this with.
This doesn't take away a tape adapter. It's just a case that makes it look kind of retro.
It looks retro because it is retro. I mean, it's a tape. It's a cassette tape. It's just a little cassette tape.
Right, but it's aesthetics. It's not a functional thing. You can't plug a nano in and then put it into your car's tape deck.
It's a case, so right, you can carry it, and it's sort of a, you know.
Are they modifying it, or do they just look like tape cassettes?
They're modifying it.
I think if they just look like cassettes, that would be a great security feature. No one would want to steal your
you know,
nano.
That's another thing. I guess it could be considered a security feature as well as sort of a recycling kind of feature. It's at 45iPodCases.com, and you know, we'll have that on the web as well. And they've got, you know, 45 different nano styles.
Yeah, and they just look like tape cassettes.
That's pretty cool. I mean, I don't know. You know, you wouldn't think they'd be neat, but they are neat. Another thing, you know, along with the recycled theme here, there's a company called Freitag, and they take recycled tarps and they use it for computer bags. Now these are really kind of neat. They're not just a regular old computer bag, but they're using tarps. A lot of them have advertising on them. I think they're in Germany or Switzerland or something, because a lot of the tarps have different languages, but they're neat little packages with colorful. There's some advertising on them, you know, but they're like real big, so you can't read anything, and plus it's in another language. And there's a lot of them to choose from, and that's at freitag.ch. So what's .ch?
Czech Republic, I believe.
Czech. So I guess they're Czechoslovakian tarps.
Nope, Czechoslovakia no longer exists. You have Slovakia and the Czech Republic.
Yes. Oh, Well, you know, wherever it is, they're really neat. It's another.
So those are basically look like just recycled advertising banners. Then,
they look like billboards that are made into messenger bags and stuff like that. You can put your computer in, and they're fairly well done, and it's all recycled stuff. So this is things like this are what's keeping all the junk out of the ocean. You know, there's that one dead spot in the ocean where there's all this, like, you know, 25 feet of junk floating. This is the kind of junk that's in there, like tarps and plastic and, you know, recycling the stuff. It's really a good idea.
All right. Thank you for that story. I think we will take a phone call now. How about we try... Of course, I need to actually choose a line first. Oh, it looks like we lost Jim, so we'll try Bill from Carmel. Bill, are you there?
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
I have a website where we sell desktops, and so you can stand at your desk. And I had heard that it was possible to invite people to advertise on the website so that we could increase our income just slightly, maybe pay for a few incidental things. Do you know anything about that and how I would get information how to do that?
How to put ads on your website?
Yeah, how I would get someone to advertise on my website.
Well, if you're going to go through all the legwork, that's pretty much...
You could ask.
Yeah, there's a whole lot of going to different companies and trying to solicit that. The easier way that a lot of people go the route of, I know one of the other geeks, Alex, does this, is he uses Google AdSense. And there are other companies that do something similar where all you do is you partner up with this company to put ads on your site, and they work out who the advertisers are and that revenue
okay.
model.
Okay. And can you say that name one more time, Google?
Google AdSense, AdSense. And they are one of them. Anyone else know some of the other competitors that are there? I know that Yahoo has a service that does this as well.
Okay.
That's assuming you don't want to do the legwork yourself. Obviously, if you want to do ads, you can always just, you know, go to a company and say, hey, here we have some ads you want to put up on our website. This is what my traffic is like.
Right. Yeah, well, this is a part-time thing, and we're a little bit short on time, so it might be helpful to do it this way.
Huh? Okay.
Great. Google AdSense. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay, and while I'm being told there are a couple of lines open, I don't see them actually listed on the phone. So what we'll do instead is go right back to news to Ryder.
Okay. More cheerful or a interesting little oopsie that Apple's patent attorneys did. They apparently, when they were submitting a patent application for their, I believe, some biometrics security patents that they were doing, they submitted some graphics that were actually illustrating the use of a jailbroken iPhone. And they had little, how you can actually tell is it has a couple of icons in there that are hallmarks of a jailbroken phone. There's the installer.app and an SMB prefs application.
So just for the folks who aren't familiar, what is a jailbroken phone?
Jailbroken phone basically allows you to run software that you haven't purchased or downloaded through the Apple App Store. And other things, like it allows you to just basically run anybody's compiled iPhone application. So
right.
You could think of it as, and you can also change carriers if you do the unlocking and whatnot. But
unlocking is a separate step. Jailbreaking
yeah.
is just
typically
apps
provided
on.
By the same people that do the jailbreaking software. Very easy to do on some versions of the iPhones and Apple iPod Touch.
Right, but something that Apple has not sanctioned.
Oh, and they've deliberately frowned on it, and they kind of say it's like stealing from us if you do this, you know.
So they frowned on it, but is it like illegal to do?
I don't think it's illegal. There's enough people out there. I mean, I'm sure they would take it to court, you know, at some point. You know, they clearly don't like it because they keep with each iteration of their firmwares and their hardware. Revving, you know, they take measures to actually prevent you from jailbreaking your iPhone.
What type of things could you get on a jailbroken phone that you can't get on the regular iPhone?
You can background your applications.
So make them run
which
in
is a big one, yeah, which is a big development no-no.
That is a big one.
Yeah.
You can
so,
tether.
You can tether.
Tethering is
using your iPhone as a modem to get your laptop on the internet.
Technomads want this feature.
Yes. So if that's something you really want, you know, tethering is a good reason to jailbreak your iPhone. Basically, a lot of applications out there that are not, you know,
video recorder
Apple,
applications,
you know, deemed worthy to put on their site. So if people are having difficulties, and there's actually, I forget the name of who's doing it, but there are people out there that are doing their own apps type service where you can download and
like
purchase applications.
Store. Yeah, like a whole jailbroken app store.
Yeah. Rogue store.
Bottom line here, though, is that Apple is frowning upon it, and yet their own lawyers
their own patent attorneys are providing illustrations of their materials using apparently a jailbroken iPhone.
So. Okay. Well, thank you for that story. And we're going to take a call from Gary. Gary, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi.
Hi. I have a little problem I thought you might be able to help me with. I have a PC. I'm a photographer. I've been trying to download my JPEGs onto a CD or to a memory stick, whatever, and go ahead and download them onto a Mac platform. And the Mac is not able to read my JPEGs. And
what program are you using to burn these CDs?
Pardon me?
What program are you using to
burn these CDs? It's a Roxio program of some sort.
Okay, you may be burning a picture CD as opposed to a data CD. And so the difference is, it's kind of like with a DVD versus a data CD, where, okay, well, with an image CD, basically you're creating this, you're adhering to the standard, so you can create the CD that will play in certain photo CD and DVD players. It hasn't really taken off. You just want to make sure you're bringing a data CD. That may not be the problem, though.
Yeah, photo CD, I thought that Macs could read those.
They should be able to, but I could see more issues arising with maybe burning a photo CD on Windows and then bringing it over to a Mac or vice versa than with a data CD.
So what is the Mac doing? When you're putting it in, is the Mac trying for a while and then spitting out the disk?
No, there's some gobbledygook that comes up on there, and that does not show any, you know, form of a JPEG.
Have you tried burning things other than images? For example, burning some office documents or text files, things like that, that that's something you can try just to see if there's a corruption with your burning process as opposed to something specific to the imaging.
Yeah, or a corruption with the actual hardware on the Mac, the disk drive on the Mac.
Well, I've tried it on a number of different Macs.
And it doesn't work on any of them?
No.
Great troubleshooting, by the way. If it doesn't work in one computer, you try it in another one.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the next thing I would try to see if actually burning itself is the issue. Or if it's burning images, that's the issue. You need to narrow that down.
Yeah, another thing you could try is using different burning mediums. So like, instead of using a certain brand of CDs or DVDs, you could try using a different brand and see if maybe you got a bad spindle.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, what kind of Mac is it that you're trying to...
Oh, there were different types. You know, I mean, just friends who have...
Were they older? Because certain Macs only read, R negative or R positive? Some of them won't read...
No, they're not older. They're all
so they're newer
up to date.
Yeah, these are CDs, right? Not DVD.
Sorry?
These are CD?
Yes,
CDRs?
They are.
Yeah. So that's...
So, okay, I hear what you're saying. And so I should always be buying the data CDs?
It's not so much the type of CD that you buy, it's the way that you burn it. So it's kind of like you could put a movie file on a disc as data, or you could burn a DVD. And the DVD would play in a DVD player, for example, but the data disk doesn't conform to that specific standard.
Right,
and so it doesn't,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I just figured JPEG is such a universal.
Yeah, it's probably a problem with the burning process, somewhere in the burning process.
Actually, I'm looking at my notes here. You tried this also with a memory stick? You tried copying to a memory stick and...
Yeah.
And that didn't...
No, actually, I didn't do it with... No, I'm sorry. I did not with a memory stick. That was something else we did.
Okay, that would be another great thing to try, is plug in a memory stick onto your Windows machine, copy the files over, just a couple of images, doesn't have to be the whole thing, and then go over to your Mac and try it out. If you can't read it, that means that there's a problem with your Mac in the way that it's able to read images.
Okay.
Either that or the way it's able to read the memory stick. Maybe it's just a weird...
The memory stick and the CDs? That seems like the...
Coincidence, like maybe, problem. But yeah. it could be possible. Yeah. I mean,
I've always gotten caught with people in the past just using the drag and drop features of some burners.
I do have. Yeah. That's what I use.
The drag and drop will not work with Macintosh.
If you
use the native Windows drag and drop, that doesn't work well with Mac.
My drag and drop is I think it's through the Roxio.
Okay. See, Roxio shouldn't have a problem. So yeah. there's something okay. else going on here.
It depends on your definition of drag and drop. I mean, if you are dragging into your application that has basically like a template set up for burning a new data CD,
I'm dragging the JPEG icon into the center of the drag and drop and dropping it there.
Like, are you dragging it onto the icon on your desktop of representing your CD?
Or you're dragging it into the Roxio window.
That file. The file's on there. I know it's there. I take it, and it works on. It works fine on PCs.
Okay.
Yeah, I think we're getting a little bit too much into minutia. Basically, I think you should try a memory stick, just a quick little USB drive, and seeing if that works. If that works, then there's a problem with the way that you're burning your disk.
Okay. As I said, the interesting thing is that it does work on another PC.
Mm-hmm. Well, one other thing you should try is in the Roxio control panel, there might be a thing that says finalize disk. Mm-hmm. And when you're doing drag and drop, there's often an option that basically says, I'm done with this disk, finalize it, I don't want to drag anything else to this. And that'll put it back into a standard that things that are not compatible with that particular format of drag and drop will be able to read. So that should help it read on a Macintosh.
Yeah. In any case, you can certainly follow up with us on our forums on our website.
Will do.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay, good.
All right. Thank you for your call.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, take care.
Bye.
Okay. So no calls waiting. Once again, if you want to call into the Geeks, our numbers are 476-2800. Or 1-800-655-5877. We have a little bit more news to go. So, Ben?
I've got kind of a goofy one. So, the popular television show Mythbusters, recently they had a bit of a boo-boo. So, they were filming a show, and they were trying to literally knock the socks off a dummy using explosives. And so,
I'm sorry, I love the Mythbusters.
I love these people. It's amazing that they have this show. That's just so much fun. Anyway, so they decided to ignite 500 pounds of ammonium nitrate 1 mile from the
in
small.
In other words, dynamite.
Yeah, one mile from the town of in Yolo County, 1 mile from the town of Esparto. And turns out they got a little bit bigger explosion, well, a lot bigger explosion than they were expecting. It actually broke several windows of houses in Esparto, the town that was a mile away, scared a whole bunch of people. No one knew that Mythbusters was filming a mile down the road because they were worried about safety. They didn't want people to all come
huddle
around the explosion
site. They didn't want
people
to come to gawk at it.
Exactly. And so no one in
and
the
it's
town.
It's a good thing, too.
Yeah, no one in the town except for the fire department knew about this. And there was this huge explosion. All these windows were broken. And it was kind of bad. They had the windows replaced the very next day, or the same day, I think. But it's just hilarious to me.
Did they knock the socks off the dummy?
They're not going to tell you that. Otherwise, you're not going to watch this show.
Yeah, right.
Who knows?
Okay, so thank you for that story. Next, we're going to take Marnie from Boulder Creek. Marnie, you there?
Hi, I'm here.
Hi.
So I have two Acer laptops bought off the shelf running XP, whatever the latest XP download was. They're a couple years old. They're running really slow. I've done lots of different cleanup things or whatever. I was enticed registry cleaner ads. What do you guys think of those?
Usually, if you're accosted by the advertisements, that's a bad sign. But if you go out and look for a registry cleaner, that's probably a better thing.
Great advice.
Well, I'm not looking for different things like, slow computer on Google, and then that was one of the things that came up as a possibility. So I started looking at it, but I don't know what the pros and cons are cleaning my registry.
One thing I always do with any software is Google the software and look at reviews of it.
Right.
But if there are any positive reviews, then
right.
It's
but
not
what about the technology itself? What the idea of cleaning a registry on Windows?
It's sound.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's sound technology. I mean, the Windows registry just gets extremely bloated over time, just installing and removing software. Often the uninstallers often don't clean everything up, so that represents more data that basically has to be processed as time goes on.
Yeah, imagine you have a filing cabinet, and every time you get some new information, tax info, whatever, you're putting it into that file cabinet. Now, a lot of that information may become defunct when you uninstall programs, but the file still stays there. Let's say you have a tax return from 13 years ago. You don't need it anymore. So what the registry cleaners are doing is getting rid of all of that stuff you don't need anymore, so it's much easier and faster for you to find the stuff you do need.
Yeah,
that's basically what's happening.
They're both really slow computers now. Okay, so if I find a reputable registry cleaner, it sounds like they're about $30 or $40, and so that would work.
I would start with the free ones that you
there,
find.
There may be some free ones.
I'd look for some open source software.
Just check online to see whether they're reputable or not, like what people think of them. But in general, it's not that complex a problem.
And I've had limited results with them. I mean, there are multiple reasons why your computer could be slow. You might need to defragment your hard drive.
I did that.
Other things, optimizations like startup optimizations. But $40 for a registry cleaner, I think, is a little expensive. I think you're probably not going to get $40 worth of value out of it in terms of speeding your computer up. I could be wrong.
Yeah, if you're going to you're going to spend $40, I'd say spend $40 on memory. Memory upgrade.
More RAM.
I mean, really the surefire way to speed it up, if it was once fast, is to reinstall Windows.
Well, that was one of the things behind the registry. It was one of the reasons it gets slower is because the hard drive is filling up and because the registry is filling up.
Yeah.
So even though the stuff in the registry, isn't hurting you, it's still slowing the accesses down.
I mean, reinstalling is kind of a last resort if you're willing to spend the time to research why it's slowing down. But that's often what I do. I just, I'm pretty cheap with my Windows maintenance. And if it's slow, I just basically just revert to a fresh install snapshot that has all my applications, and I'm good to go. But
the most important thing, back up your hard drive before you do it.
Okay.
Because if you mess anything up in the registry that's really important, then you could have serious, serious issues.
Right.
So that's the most important thing always, is have a backup before you do something like this.
Okay, so that is really important.
Absolutely.
Oh, backups in general are absolutely important, but whenever you're going to do something that's going to affect the core system, that's even, it makes the reason for a backup that much more relevant.
Okay.
So thank you for your call, Marnie.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
And registries are, certain files on your system. So if you were just touching the registries, you can just back up the registry files as well. And then you can Google on how to do that.
Yes. Okay. So once again, we have no calls waiting, but we're getting a little bit late. And no, I guess I can give out the numbers again. 476-2800 or 1-800-655-5877. We've got a full gamut. I think we can handle just about any question that comes our way. In terms of the geeks and our skill sets here. Now, with regard to news, who's up next? Who's got something?
Well, I just want to say we got a Twitter from the original Technomad, the coiner of the term, Steve Roberts, is listening to the show right now up in Camano Island, Washington. So he's one of the most amazing geeks you'll ever meet. His website is nobadness.com. He's building a geeked out sailboat right now and is one of our inspirations for doing all this traveling. So, hey, Steve, I'm glad you're listening.
Wow, I feel famous. Okay, and we're still, some calls are coming in, but I don't know who's there yet.
I have a great energy cleaner.
Yeah, so come hit me with
that. This is another green thing, a green theme here. And this is charging a device. Imagine a little battery, okay? And the battery can charge things like your cell phone or your iPod or things like that. And this little device has a fan attached to it. So if you hold it in your hand, it's got a fan. So it can generate power with the fan. So when you could hook it, they have pictures of it on their website. It's called the Hymeny. You can hook it to your shoulder while you're driving your bike, and the fan is spinning, and it's generating power. You can plug it into the wall and charge it up that way. It also has little solar panels that you can clip to it with a wire.
that will charge the battery with the solar panel. And the solar panels come in cardboard enclosures. So these guys are taking it really far. I mean, a little solar panel, cardboard thing, and you can link them in series and charge this thing up and use it to charge up your, you know, all your little devices. They have, you know, examples of iPods, cell phones, cameras, PDAs. They say that if you're trying to capture power in about 20 minutes, you can charge for 4 minutes of talk time on a 3G mobile phone. And in 20 minutes, you could charge 40 minutes of playtime for an MP3. So this thing is like, seriously, I mean, you can charge it with a USB, plug it in your computer and charge it up. It's just portable power. I've never seen anything that has some – actually, I've never seen a wind-powered battery generator, you know, personal wind power. You know, this is like a serious, you know, green power, you know. And it's called the Hymeny, and it's hymeny.com.
And we'll have the link up on the website?
Yep.
Okay. So let's take a call from Susie in Santa Cruz. Hello, Susie.
Hi.
Hi. You have a question about viruses.
Well, I was just curious. It's kind of a long shot, but something that you said earlier on your show made me kind of wonder. My internet is down, and I am getting this error message that says, "We're sorry, AT&T has found a problem with your internet account." But I call AT&T, and they don't know anything about it, and they say my account's fine, and my bill's paid, and everything, and the router seems to be working fine, and the modem seems to be working fine. I don't know if they're working, but all the lights are normal, and we've unplugged them and plugged them back in, and I just thought, hey, maybe it'd be worth checking to see if this was any kind of interesting, unusual virus or anything, because you had said something earlier, and
a virus could cause this, but I'm not inclined to believe it is.
Okay.
The easiest way is to test another computer on the network.
All of the computers on our network are pulling up the same. Oh, so then, yeah, that wouldn't be a virus.
So they're saying that you can't get internet connectivity on the computer. You try connecting, it says, we cannot connect to the internet.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
So each computer, when you try to connect to the internet, yes. What kind of message does it say?
It all directs to this same AT&T message, all of the ones on our
So maybe the DHCP server is not functioning.
I've seen something like this, and when I saw it, it was usually attributed to when you you have DSL, you usually have to authenticate the DSL. It's PPP over Ethernet, I believe, or DHCP, and it's authenticated. And if you have the wrong authentication, it will usually kind of spit out an error like that.
Right, but you had called into AT&T. They were trying to troubleshoot with you?
Called in what? I didn't hear what you said.
Well, you were saying that you were unplugging things and plugging things back in again. That was with AT&T tech support?
Yeah, and they couldn't seem to figure out what was wrong, if anything.
And they just said, sorry, we can't help you, and then just hung up? Or...
Well, I mean, they gave up. They were suggesting that perhaps I hadn't registered, but we've been using it for months, and it's just all of a sudden a problem now, and so it just... I actually had to hang up with them because I had an appointment that I had to leave for.
Yeah, I'd say call them back because this sounds like something that AT&T needs to fix. I don't think there's anything that you can do per se.
Okay, got it.
And with the big companies like AT&T who are, you know, have thousands and thousands of subscribers, sometimes their tech support doesn't actually know, even when a large
portion. That was the sense that I had, was that this guy was really just shooting high for, like, whatever he could think of And it was really hard to understand him because he had a really thick Indian accent, and that's really frustrating for me with tech support that's outsourced. It makes the whole process challenging for me because I'm not very good at understanding.
Yeah, I think you need to call him back.
Yeah, best of luck to you. Thanks for calling.
Thanks so much.
All right, take care. Okay, do we have time for... Let's give it a shot. We got Norm in Santa Cruz.
Nope.
No, here we go. Norm?
Yeah. Yes, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I want to know if you guys know of a virus protection program called NOD32 and how it compares to McAfee. Like, I've got McAfee Security Center, and it really bogs down my laptop, but somebody told me that this NOD32 is much less resource-intensive, and it makes the computer much more faster.
Never heard of it.
Yeah.
I don't know about a virus scanner being inherently so much faster. Admittedly, Norton, I think, is one of the slower ones. But virus scanners, just by virtue of what they do, are going to slow your system down. There's no perpetual motion machine to make that much faster. So
yeah.
I'd be a little wary about claims like that.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, take care.
Yeah, it looks like they exist on the internet, and there are comparisons dating back to at least 2002. I just did a quick Google search, but who knows if they're actually reputable or yeah. I don't know.
It's possible. I don't know. Yeah. We haven't heard of it, so we can't endorse it.
It's you know, fire scanner performance is subjective in so many ways. You know, it's yeah.
So another hour of Geek Speak has gone by. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, and KBDH San Ardo, streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. This has been Geek Speak. In the air room with me has been Ben Jaffe, Al Luckow, Ryder Brooks, Chris Dumphy, and Cherie Viard.
Yay!
Thank you for joining us. Thank you all for... Yeah, I got the name right. Thank you all for joining me.
Certainly.
Thank you.